Hello, and welcome to this first episode of Season 7 of The Dark Money Files, in which we shine a light into a murky world. I'm Ray Blake, and with me is my co-host, friend, and business partner, Graham Barrow. Hello, Graham.
Season 7. Whoa, hello, Ray.
I know, yeah. Now, look, that's a provocative title for our first episode of 2021. Do you want to explain?
Well, I will, Ray, that the shells in question are companies rather than ordnance, and it turns out they had quite a role to play in the explosion that devastated Beirut back in August of 2020.
And before we begin, we should point out that there's an article on the Dark Money Files LinkedIn page to accompany the podcast, because that's going to help with some of the detail as we explain the story.
Yes, absolutely, Ray.
So how did we get involved in this story, Graham?
Ray, we were approached by a Lebanese filmmaker called Feras Hatoum, who was making a documentary on the massive explosion in Beirut last year, and who'd made some really interesting discoveries about the role of one particular UK company in that explosion.
There's always one, isn't there, Graham?
Well, in this case, Ray, it turns out there was more than one. But generally, yes, it seems to be every story that's ever reported, there's always at least one.
Okay. I know we'll explain more as we go along, but we should start by quickly summarising what happened last August.
I completely agree, Ray. Do you want to kick that off?
Yep, I'll do that. So, following a fire in a warehouse in the port of Beirut, believed to have been caused by sparks from a welder, a fire took hold, which eventually spread to a warehouse containing ammonium nitrate.
Which is a beast of a thing at the very best of times.
And this wasn't the best of times, Graham. It was 2,700 metric tons of unstable ammonium nitrate that was leaking from the bags it was stored in, had been kept in pretty poor conditions for around 6 years, and was literally a bomb waiting to go off.
And go off it did.
In the most catastrophic manner. It was estimated that the blast was equivalent to about one-tenth of a nuclear explosion, and according to one expert, was almost certainly the biggest blast ever witnessed other than those caused by atomic bombs.
See, even that is hard to get your head around.
The pictures of the devastation it caused are truly shocking. More than 200 people died and more than 7,500 were injured.
And I'm not trying to be flippant here, Ray, when I say that those figures are actually quite remarkably low in light of the damage that that explosion caused.
Damage valued at more than $15 billion, Graham.
Yeah, and on top of that, it's estimated that the blast left more than 300,000 people homeless.
And the great port of Beirut unable for some time to accept fairly important deliveries.
Oh, absolutely.
You know, this is one more story drowned out by the pandemic that in any other year would have run and run.
And Ray, it is a good reason to come back to it now, although I'm going to be honest, the UK will not necessarily emerge very well from the story we're about to tell.
Nor many others, I fear, but the story needs telling.
Absolutely, it does. And before we do, one final anecdote about the explosion. According to reporting, the blast was felt as far away as Turkey, Syria, Israel, Palestine and parts of Europe. And it was heard in Cyprus, more than 150 miles away.
It's extraordinary. Well, that's the blast. What about the shells?
Well, after the investigation got underway, it was discovered that the ammonium nitrate was offloaded from a ship called the MV Rosas, which had docked in Beirut some years previously, allegedly on its way from Batumi in Georgia, and that's the one in Eastern Europe, not the one in America, to Beira in Mozambique.
And as I understand it, the boat was Moldovan flagged, but owned by a Panamanian company. Although the captain regarded the ultimate owner as a Russian. That's disputed, however.
It's already, Ray, sounding like a typical Dark Money Files investigation. In one sentence or two, we've already covered six different countries.
Yeah. Well, either way, after the boat docked in Beirut, it was considered unseaworthy and wasn't allowed to leave. The cargo of ammonium nitrate was brought ashore in 2014 and stored in a warehouse in the port.
And apparently the boat sank in the harbour in 2018.
But the story hasn't. And here we need to introduce our first UK entity, don't we?
Ray, we do, and it's called Savaro Limited, and according to paperwork, which has been reproduced on the internet and not denied at all, Savaro was the entity which entered into a contract with that Georgian company for the supply of 2,750 metric tons of ammonium nitrate, and that's the stuff that was offloaded in Beirut.
A British company, Graham?
Well, it was a shell, Ray, British in name only. None of the directors or owners had any real connection to the UK. And by the way, throughout its entire history, it has always filed dormant accounts.
It's a strange usage of the word dormant, isn't it, Graham?
Ray, shells have their own rules.
Have they declared a person with significant control?
They have, and it's a lady called Marina Psilou, who has cropped up before in our investigations.
Although we should say before we go any further that we're making no allegations of any kind in this podcast, merely reporting what we found in free-to-access open-source registries and other sites of interest.
Exactly. Two of which are firstly Open Corporates, which tells me that Ms. Psilou is or has been an officer to 157 companies worldwide. And secondly, according to Open Ownership, is or has been the owner or controller of four companies. Three of those in the UK and one, slightly oddly, is in Ukraine.
So we might reasonably presume from the 157 directorships that she's more of a proxy than a hands-on director.
Well, I think that's a very fair assessment, Ray. And two of Ms. Psilou's PSC roles, persons with significant control, are with the aforementioned Savaro and another company in the UK called Interstatus Limited. Remember that name?
Mm.
That also happens to be the company secretary of Savaro, where Ms. Psilou is also the director. And that's a role they perform, by the way, for more than 60 other UK entities.
This is getting more and more shell-like the more we investigate.
Yes, and I think now is the time to introduce our second company, Ray.
Which is?
HESCO Engineering and Construction Company Limited.
And why are we interested in this one?
Oh, you better believe this. It was recently dissolved, and by recently I mean November 2020, and it was a company formed in 2005.
Mm-hmm.
The initial shareholders were a couple of gentlemen called George Hazwani and his son-in-law, Youssef Arbaksh.
Now, why are those names interesting?
They are both sanctioned individuals, and they were sanctioned by OFAC for allegedly acting as intermediaries between the Syrian government and ISIS.
Ooh.
And those OFAC sanctions specifically mention HESCO, which it calls a Syrian construction and engineering company.
It also sanctioned two brothers called Mudalal and Imad Khoury at the same time, didn't it?
Yes, it did, and we will come back to them later in the podcast. Now, the sanctions against George and the Khouries were issued at the same time on the 25th of November 2015. This was followed on the 21st of July 2016 by Mr. Arbaksh for his role as head of HESCO's Russian operations.
Hold on. Didn't you just say that the company only recently dissolved? That's odd, isn't it, if the owners were sanctioned?
Well, Mr. Hazwani, despite being a shareholder, never declared himself as a PSC. And strangely, Mr. Arbaksh, when he did declare himself as a PSC, managed to misspell his name as Abraksh.
Bit of an airbrush then, really.
No, Abraksh, not Abraksh.
Oh, sorry.
But he did, and that was despite the fact the declaration was filed on the 20th of October 2016 after he had been sanctioned.
Oops. And before we dive into the detail, I believe we have a third company to introduce, don't we?
Yes, we do. This company is called Alpha, with an F, Procurement and Machinery Limited.
Which I see dissolved in 2017, so it's not been active for a while.
No, it hasn't, but it did boast Mr. Arbash as one of its directors, as well as the sole shareholder at the time of dissolution.
OK, any other directors, Graham?
Yes, Ray, Interstatus.
What, the same one that Savaro had?
Yes.
Okay, so we've got three companies. Two, Hesco and Alpha, share a sanctioned individual as director and shareholder. And two, Savaro and Alpha, share a second director, Interstatus. Bit circumstantial still.
It is, but it's also worth noting that all three were initially registered to the same address. All three changed their address on the same day to the same new address. And all three changed the location of their register on the same day to the same new location.
Okay, that's a bit more compelling. I'm convinced they're connected. Anything else?
Yes. When you look at the scans of both the change of address and the change of register location forms, because they were filed on paper, not only is the handwriting identical, all of those forms were signed by Ms. Psilou, but they were all signed on by her on behalf of Interstatus, which is odd, as it had nothing whatever to do with Hesco.
Allegedly. Oops.
Oops, indeed.
So if I understand this correctly, Graham, we have three UK companies, one of which we've seen evidence showing it was the supplier of the ammonium nitrate, which ended up in Beirut to such devastating effect, and two of which are linked to sanctioned individuals who were accused of supplying ISIS and which have strong links to both Russia and the regime in Syria.
That is right, Ray. And of course, ISIS have also been associated with the use of ammonium nitrate in the construction of improvised explosive devices and other types of bombs.
That's amazing. And two of those three UK companies were active until very recently.
Well, in fact, Marina Psilou filed a voluntary strike-off notice on the very same day as Firas Hatoum's original story aired on Al Jadeed TV in the Lebanon earlier this week, Ray.
That's hardly likely to be a coincidence, I think.
I think there are too many linked events for my liking in any way, Ray.
Mm. Now, you mentioned the Khoury brothers earlier. We know from the OFAC sanctions announcement that they were strongly linked to George Haswani. What else do we know?
Imad Khoury is also on the paperwork of a still active British company called IK Petroleum Industrial Company Limited.
Really? And it's still active despite him being a sanctioned person?
Well, yes. On the last shareholder statement in 2015, prior to the commencement of the PSC regime, he is shown as a 50% shareholder alongside a Russian gentleman called Igor Ivanik. However, only Mr. Ivanik declared himself as a PSC following the introduction of that regime in April 2016.
Well, how fortunate for Mr. Khoury. Dare I ask who else has been a director for IK Petroleum?
Interstatus, Ray. Although they did resign in 2016.
Really? Anything else?
Mr. Ivanik started a new company in 2019 called Industrial Equipment Engineering Limited, appointing the same secretary, they're called Omega Agents, that also now act for IK Petroleum in place of Interstatus Limited.
Okay. Wow. Okay. So, Graham, reflecting on everything we've discovered, here are my thoughts. We have a network of UK companies which appear to be involved in the purchase of dangerous chemicals, which blew up much of Beirut, which are or were allegedly involved in facilitating the sale of oil on behalf of ISIS, which were or are still being owned or controlled by globally sanctioned individuals.
Yeah. And the only reason, Ray, that we are able to bring this story to the general public, the only way we are able to shine this particular light into a very murky world, is because the UK operates a fully open, free-to-access corporate and beneficial ownership registry.
That's exactly right. And in the week that Companies House has put on that public registry all the corporate filings for any firm that dissolved from 2010 onwards rather than 2015 as it used to be, we now have hundreds of thousands of additional records with which to conduct similar research.
Which means that a whole range of research projects we had to put on hold because we simply couldn't afford the fees to access the records can now be brought forward and pursued as vigorously as we have pursued this one.
Although I've got to say, we'll very rarely have quite such a compelling story to tell as this one.
No, indeed. And we also need to give full credit to that Lebanese journalist, Firas Hatoum, who alerted us to the story in the first place, and to which I strongly believe we've now been able to add considerably more meat to the bones.
Now, look, Graham, we really enjoyed going off topic a bit over Christmas and the New Year period. And if our listeners heard our four 2020 review specials, they'll have noticed we tackled these a little differently from our usual podcast topics. It was fun.
Well, for us, it definitely was. And I imagine some of our audience will have enjoyed it more than maybe others did.
Well, I think we can confidently assert that's the case, Graham, given the different flavours of feedback we've had.
Yes. Now, there are people who rely on the Dark Money Files for their CPD to learn about or stay up to date with financial crime topics.
And for us, that's our core mission. It's why we started the podcast, and it's central to our professional endeavours. The podcast is our main public contribution to the fight against financial crime. It's free, and it always will be.
It is. But from the earliest days, we've been aware that there are listeners who are happy to listen to us rabbit on about all sorts of things.
They do say there's a market for everything, don't they?
Well, they do, and apparently there is. And any market we can supplement our income from is one I'm very happy to visit.
Well, yes, it's been a funny old year. That's a truism as well as a cliche. But like many, we've found that we can't rely on the ways we've traditionally supported ourselves and our families and need to get a bit more creative.
So killing multiple avian creatures with one single missile, or maybe a shell, we've developed a Patreon offering.
Yes. Now, if you're new to Patreon, it's a popular way for artists and other podcasters to monetize their efforts, offering patrons some additional content in return.
And it's purely voluntary. And if you do nothing at all at this point, you'll continue to get every episode of the podcast, which we'll deliver to you in the normal way with all of the information, news and insights it's always had just as regularly.
And that will always be the case.
But if you want to invest in the podcast and get access to some extras, the facility now exists. It's based on a monthly contribution model, and we've ordered such contributions into a three-tiered model, which in GBP is the gallery at £3 a month, the circle at £7.50 a month, and the stalls at £12.50 per month.
Like in the theatre, Graham.
Yeah, exactly that. Although maybe don't expect much by way of theatrics.
Yes. So, assuming the additional content scales to the contribution, what can a gallery patron expect?
At that level, you'll get special early access to our podcasts, 48 hours prior to regular subscribers, and they will be longer because we'll be introducing each of them with Patreon subscriber messages and content that won't go out in the regular episode. You'll also have access to a new TDMF newsletter called The Financial Crime Scene, in which one of us will provide fresh insight into the major financial crime stories or developments that have occurred since the previous newsletter.
I'm pretty excited about that one.
Well, yes. And spend a bit more with us, and there's a range of additional benefits too. Priority access to our live events, assuming we can get back to those soon, as well as exclusive extras and online events that we'll be running just for the patrons.
What sort of things?
Well, one will be a monthly, I think, The Dark Money Files After Dark, which will be a podcast where we talk about non-financial crime things.
Like what crime?
Well, books we've read, TV and cultural items, perhaps even a bit of politics.
Oh, sounds edgy.
It might be, but it'll certainly be good fun.
We'll also put on Ask Us Anything sessions, where we'll witter on pretty much to order on the subjects of your choice.
I've always wanted to do something like that.
Fancy. So, how do people get access to all this?
Well, they need to browse to patreon.com/TDMF and sign up. New communication and discussion options will then open up and the new content will start popping up automatically.
As easy as that.
Exactly that. For a full breakdown of the content each tier unlocks, do check the website at patreon.com/TDMF.
What's next, Graham?
Well, while all this has been going on, Ray, the US has taken its first rather tentative steps along the road to requiring full beneficial ownership disclosure through the recently enacted Corporate Transparency Act, which is part of the what's known as the NDAA, the National Defense Authorizations Act. So maybe we should talk about that.
They've been busy, those Americans, recently, haven't they? Yeah. Well, I'm looking forward to it. We'll be right back.